Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 234 it is, a number that signifies moving forward, apparently. I have to say a big thank you to Adi and Janice, who hosted me at their farm, Kalmusfontein, this week as part of the Swartland Revolution events they're running. I was invited to give a little talk about Jan Smuts of the Swartland and relished the opportunity to delve deeply into a great South African's early life. And to all the folks who came to ask questions and be part of the event, thank you too for such an amazing reception. We're going to deal with two main topics in the years 1871 leading into 1872, this episode. One was the installation of Sir John Maltino as the first Prime Minister of the Cape of Good Hope. That marked the start of responsible government, self-government in the territory. But the other really big event of 1872 was the death of Zulu King Mpande Ka Zenzangakhona, leaving the way open for Cetshwayo Ka Mpande to seize the reins of power. It wasn't going to be that simple, of course. Let's have a quick squiz at what was going on globally in 1871. The Franco-Prussian War ended, leading to the proclamation of the German Empire in January. The North German Federation and the South German states were united in a single nation state, and the King of Prussia was declared Emperor Wilhelm I. Otto von Bismarck would soon become the first Chancellor of the German Empire. In French Algeria, the Mokrani Rebellion against colonial rule broke out in March. Also in March, the Paris Commune was formally established in France. The Commune governed Paris for 2 months, promoting an anti-religious system, an eclectic mix of many 19th century schools of thought. Its policies included the separation of church and state, the reduction of rent, and the abolition of child labor. The Commune closed all Catholic churches and schools in Paris, and a mix of reformism and revolutionism took hold, a hodgepodge of folks who pushed back against the French establishment. By late May 71, the Commune had been crushed in the Semaine-Sanglante, the Bloody Week, where at least 15,000 communards were executed by loyalist troops. More than 43,000 communards were imprisoned. The Paris Commune left an indelible mark on Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, two men who in turn would go on to cast a long indirect shadow over the course of world history. In June 1871, the United States launched an assault on the Han River forts in Korea, hoping to pry open Korean markets for American trade. Washington wasn't bothering with tariffs that year. Gunboats were quicker. In the U.S. state of Wisconsin, the Peshtigo Fire killed 2,500 people in October 71, making it the deadliest fire in U.S. history. Later in the same month, a massive fire broke out in Chicago, killing 300, destroying 17,500 buildings and leaving 100,000 people homeless, all just before winter. The London Australia Telegraph Cable made it to Darwin in the Northern Territories. At the end of 1871, gold was discovered at Pilgrim's Creek in the Eastern Transvaal, where Pilgrim's Rest is today. And on his way there was former Diggers Republic President Stafford Parker. More about that gold rush in later episodes. Remember, the British annexed Griqualand West in 1871. Then in November 1871, Winston Churchill was born, another character who was going to shape part of South Africa's history. Charles Babbage died on Boxing Day, 26 December 1871, a man of many labels, mathematician, philosopher, inventor, mechanical engineer, but one overriding legacy. He imagined the computer before electricity even entered the equation. Babbage's difference engine was the first mechanical attempt to automate calculation. It was his analytical engine that quietly cracked open the future. It carried in its brass and gears the essential ideas of the modern digital computer, the logic, memory, and even programmability. His inspiration was a Jacquard loom, which used punched cards to weave patterns into silk. Babbage observed this machine and thought, if a loom could follow instructions to weave flowers, why not numbers? Hidden in that question was the dawn of the information age and even the first glimmer of a printer. In South Africa, the news of the end of the Franco-Prussian War was reported in newspapers like De Suid-Afrikaan and De Suid-Afrikaan Verenigde met de Volksvriend, both reflecting the Dutch view in matters, including their support of a new self-governed Cape Colony. More about that in a moment. An isiXhosa newspaper, isiGimidi samaXhosa, was published in Lovedale. News of John Maltino's installation as Prime Minister was more important to the readers of the isiGimidi samaXhosa than German unification. The Cape Parliament finally voted to accept responsible government in 1871. If they hadn't taken this step, the alternative would have been to move in the opposite direction by reducing the power of the Cape legislature. Gladstone was the new British Prime Minister. He was sick and tired of the colonials. The policies that got him elected, including legislation for reforms, particularly the Army Enlistment Act of 1870. He was focused on efficiency and economy in government. Gladstone's government also oversaw other significant changes to the judicial system and the introduction of income tax. Behind the scenes loomed the strident voice of the Secretary of State for War, Edward Cardwell. The German Empire's stunning triumph over the Second French Empire in the Franco-Prussian War proved that the Prussian system of professional soldiers, with their up-to-date weapons and tactics, were far superior to the traditional system of gentlemen soldiers that Britain used. Cardwell wanted change. He believed that Cape Town Harbour was essential to the functioning of the British Empire. That was to supply its army and navy as they navigated through the Indian and Atlantic Oceans to India. But unless the Cape government paid its fair share, he threatened to withdraw all British troops, except for those at the Simonstown garrison. This put the fear of God into the Cape, and particularly the Eastern Cape English elite. They had grown rich, partly on the business with the British troops housed in forts around their territory. Interestingly, Cardwell's modernizing British army was being forged at precisely the moment a very different military evolution was underway across the seas in Zululand. Within a decade, these two forces, both reshaped by the pressures of modern warfare, one by imperial doctrine and the other by indigenous adaptation, would meet in open combat. Back to the Cape self-government saga. The British faced a real dilemma. Governor Sir Philip Wodehouse, among others, warned that the settlers at the Cape, and especially in Natal, couldn't be trusted to govern black people fairly. There were serious doubts about handing over power to men whose sense of justice didn't appear to stretch further than their own fences. Wodehouse had therefore pushed back against responsible government on humanitarian grounds, but the changing of the political guard in Britain put pay to his pushback. Throughout most of the 1860s, the Cape was dominated by a political struggle between the Unionists and the Republicans, to use simplified terms. The political deadlock was mirrored by economic stagnation and sharp regional fractures between the Cape's provinces, the Eastern Cape, the Western Cape. Governor Wodehouse, reluctant to hand over full control to local leaders, argued they were just as likely to revise systems of coercive labour, thinly veiled forms of servitude, as they were to establish equitable governance. These opponents feared that transferring power to local politicians would destabilize the colony, particularly given its complex racial makeup and economic dependence on a hierarchically structured labour system. So Wodehouse dissolved Parliament in 1869 in an attempt to thwart the movement when it appeared to be on the cusp of voting in favour of self-government. However, during the 1870-71 session, the tide began to turn. Although the Legislative Council remained divided, the House of Assembly increasingly favoured responsible government. After Wodehouse's recall and the appointment of Sir Henry Barclay, the movement gained momentum. In essence, the debates of 1870-71 marked the final and decisive political struggle in a long campaign for Cape local self-rule, highlighting tensions between imperial authority, settler aspirations, and the shadow of coercive labour systems. The popular movement towards responsible government had arisen in the early 1860s, led by John Maltino, and in a future podcast, I'll spend more time on his life, a fascinating character. He was the first South African to attempt to export fruit, for example. He married a coloured woman called Berea in 1841, but catastrophe struck when she and their young son died in childbirth. And stricken by grief, he joined a Boer commando fighting in one of the early frontier wars. Back to our story today. So these colonists sought to make the government of the country accountable or responsible to Parliament and the local electorate rather than some distant queen or secretary of war. This meant the Cape gained a degree of independence from Britain in 1872, and the ensuing years were marked by a rapid surge in economic growth, a countrywide expansion of infrastructure, as well as a period of regional integration and social development, a new Cape, and perhaps a new Natal. But it was just by a single vote that the Cape Legislative Council accepted self-government in 1872, finally. The vote came after years of growing tension between the elected House of Assembly, which had favoured self-rule, and unelected Legislative Council, where imperial loyalists held more sway. The council's narrow vote to approve the motion reflected a deep division within the colony's political elite. It was this razor-thin majority that allowed the passage of the motion, enabling the Cape to adopt responsible government. Maltino was duly installed as Prime Minister, along with a Dutch Speaker of Parliament, Christoffel Brandt, founder of the Zuid Afrikaan newspaper, and it so happened father of the president of the Orange Free State, Johannes Brandt. Maltino managed to heal the Eastern Cape, Western Cape divisions by appointing members from all regions to his cabinet and reorganizing the constituencies. One of the most important members of his new cabinet was J.H. de Villiers, whose shadow was going to loom over South African law from that day to this. J.H. de Villiers considered himself more French than Dutch, which is ironic because Maltino had no other Afrikaners in his cabinet. They were all English. Maltino was facing other ironies, or at least political uniqueness, which we all know is part of South Africa's history. The majority of whites in the Cape in 1872 were Dutch-speaking, and we're talking about 55 to 60% here. Furthermore, the vast majority of coloured Kapenaars were also Dutch-speaking, and yet there were no Dutch-speaking cabinet members. That exacerbated the constant friction over culture and language during this period. There was another reality, economic. By 1870, the Amamfengu people around Pedi in the Ciskar were producing more agricultural goods and being more productive than the Albany municipality around Grahamstown, which increased the number of black voters in the Eastern Cape. This may come as a bit of a surprise, but any black person owning land could vote back in 1872. There was no separate chamber. They were voting for a legislative representative in the Cape Parliament, although their representatives were all white. Parliamentary life in Natal, by contrast, was less advanced. The settlers were radically opposed to blacks and Indians getting any right to vote. The overriding sentiment, backed up by legions of documents, folks, was xenophobic to an extraordinary degree. They were far more inclined to bat away suggestions of the franchise being extended to blacks, far more inclined than the Eastern Cape or Western Cape. In many senses, the Natal colonists were aping what the Free State and Transvaal Boers were saying about blacks voting. Ach, sis, nee, man. Oh, good heavens, old chap. Great Scott. No, no, no. Won't do. So when the word began to circulate that Mpande Ka Senzangakona was no more, a shiver swept through the Natal colony. What was going to happen? Would the Zulus rise up once more and plunge south over the Tukela River? Since we left the eastern seaboard about 10 episodes ago, the region had seen an uptick in farming, particularly in the Midlands of Natal. New workers in the form of indentured labour had been shipped in from India, and as you heard in episode 233, a 17-year-old callow youth had also arrived to work on his family's cotton farm in Richmond, Cecil John Rhodes. Thus, we need to deal with the death of Mpande Ka Senzangakona, because his son Cetshwayo Ka Mpande was chafing to take over. He wasn't the only one, as you're going to hear. So it was then that on the 22nd of October 1872, Cetshwayo summoned all the Ndunas and Isikhulu to Kwa Nondwengu to announce that King Mpande had died. We don't know exactly when he died, because the councillors and the women of the Isigodlo kept his death a secret, closely guarded, saying for some days, some say weeks, that the king was indisposed, which was noticeable because October is just before one of the main ceremonies to be conducted by the Zulu king, the first fruit ceremony, Mkhosi Wokweshama. Most who heard the phrase indisposed guessed that he was dead, but there was a good reason to keep the truth bottled up. There were competitors who sought the throne, and Cetshwayo needed to ensure that all protocols were observed. Dingane's end had been chaotic. Protocols trampled, dignity cast aside. Mpande at least was spared that. His memory remained intact, at least at first. Revisionists would change that later. He was accorded all the trappings of a proper funeral. As author John Labunt says, he would be the last Zulu monarch to receive all the trappings of a proper funeral for a Zulu king, including sacrifice. His body would be buried some weeks hence. First, he was wrapped in the skin of a freshly slaughtered ox, a death swaddle. Only his head was left exposed. His body was propped up in a squatting position against one of the wooden poles in his main hut in the Isigutlo, and fires of aromatic box and wood, as well as bones, were kept blazing away day and night. This masked the smell of death and desiccated the body, which was eventually odorless and ready to be interred. The day of burial was another secret. Tradition had it that evil spirits may be warned about his passing to the other side and play havoc. Mpandi was wrapped in four blankets woven of different colors and dressed in a kaross of jackal fur. Here, a combination of tradition and modern European textiles. The grave was the shape of a boot, and Mpandi was placed in the toe, propped up on the stones, his personal items alongside, his spoons, some ornaments, beshu, his loin covering, his beads, his sleeping mats. His four wooden chairs that he was so fond of were burnt, and four of his spears were carried to the Ntukwini River near modern-day Ulundi to be buried in the rocky pools there. This was to stop the Idlozi, the evil ones, from wielding his weapons and mystically injuring Mpande in the afterlife. At least two of his wives and a few concubines were to follow Mpande into the spirit world. As per tradition, along with his male body servant, all sacrificed. And as per tradition, the incoming regent Kajwayo selected the two unfortunate women confidentially. They were to be grabbed without warning, their mouths covered and then strangled. Makanda, who was Mpande's body servant, the man who'd sewn the headrings onto both Dingane and Mpande, was selected to be sacrificed. Instead, he bolted to the Ngoya forest and could not be found. So Tlechwayo ordered that his place be taken by his uncle, Nhlangano Kalubata, of the Ntuli people. The British and the missionaries were totally against this practice, and Tlechwayo was to fib later, saying it never happened. Oral tradition is very clear about this. The sacrifices went ahead, although not without a hitch. One of the wives heard about the plan and also bolted. In Nhlangano, Kalubatra was killed and laid down like a mat, and Mpande's body placed on his. Zulu oral history speaks of others being executed to join Mpande, but this has not been confirmed. While all of these things were going on, Tlechwayo wasn't present. He remained at his great place near Mpangeni down the Mhlathuzi River. It was Mpande's chief Induna, Masipula, who took the lead on many things now. Masipula apparently took pity on one of the would-be sacrificed wives and let her live. This infuriated Kechwayo when he heard about it later. So Masipula conducted the last rites, and finally Mpande's grave was filled in, covered with stones, then fenced off. A small local homestead, an imuzi, was tasked with ensuring the gravesite was protected, and they had to burn the grass around the grave every year. Within a few years, a small thicket had grown on the mound. Mpande's Kwanundwengu Ikanda was abandoned, and today you can visit Mpande's grave inside a museum in Ulundi. Tlechwayo was now free to commence the work of King of the Zulus. On the 26th of February, 1873, he sent messengers to Pietermaritzburg to let the British Secretary of Native Affairs, Theophilus Shepston, know formally of Mpande's passing. Tlechwayo invited Shepston to travel to Zululand to crown him king and formally cement ties between the British Empire and the Zulu Empire. There was another obvious irony here. In 1840, Mpande had ridden south when Dingane died and met the Boers. He was duly proclaimed king by the short-lived Republic Natalia. When the British took over in 1843, they too recognized Mpande. A rare moment of continuity between rival colonizers. Now, decades later, his son Tlechwayo was the one making a journey, this time to the British, hat slightly in hand, seeking the same seal of approval. It was this act that was going to create a headache for the new king. The traditionalists were completely against this form of diplomacy, Masipula being one. Tlechwayo was planning his diplomacy, aiming at British recognition, because the Boer states to his north were now encroaching on the Utrecht district, otherwise known as the disputed territory, which lay between the colony of Natal and the Suid-Afrikaanse Republiek, or the Transvaal, all to the west and north of what is northern Zululand. The region is bounded by the Drakensberg Escarpment in the west and by the Balelisberg in the north, which hinge eastward towards Swaziland. If the British recognized Cetshwayo as king, he could begin to deal with the disputed territory, thought Cetshwayo. Internally, there was a crisis growing because not all Izikhulu, the senior chiefs, supported Cetshwayo's claim that he should be the next Zulu regent. What happened next? This was episode 235. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I load updates about various episodes. You can register for my newsletter there or email me. Salagahle.